Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Wow, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle. Match day 33 is in the books. Doyle, we're operating on precious little sleep, at least I am. I want to say I woke up 15 minutes before this podcast, but I did do one important thing before we break down all the comings and goings in the East and the West and the playoff races. I got a new microphone set up. We're living in a new era of Extra Time. I'm practically yelling into this thing. How do I sound? Dulcet tones, overblown?
It is velvety smooth, Andrew. You should be very happy. It's finally some equipment that matches your golden vocal cords.
So nice of you.
You said you did one thing before the show. Does that include picking up your mom at the airport? Did you strand your mom at the airport?
Oh, my God. Oh, no, it was actually 9:10 p.m. And I had it in my head as 9:10 a.m.
Okay.
So crisis averted, but okay. Nana is coming. Okay. Nana is coming. So
that would have been a very weeby thing.
Yeah. I appreciate that you're checking up on me like that. That's true friendship.
You didn't wake up this morning at like 8 a.m. Okay. So you sorted this out.
Correct. I woke up at 11:45 a.m. God bless my saint of a wife. I heard her getting the boys ready for school, which is normally my job, and they were absolutely on one this morning, as was MLS on Wednesday night. Let's give you a little breakdown before we jump in and give you the best thing we saw. In the East, no Tata in Atlanta. He was watching up in the luxury boxes, 8 rotations, the most of the year for Miami. None of Messi and friends started. Miami had a lead, and they lost it. Alexi Moranchuk had a welcomed MLS banger. We'll have more on that in a little bit. The state of Ohio stood tall on the road. Yuya Kubo fueled Cincy in Minnesota. And Cucho came off the bench to sink Toronto FC, who are above the playoff line, but I think could very well sink below it by the end of the season. We have a new fourth place team in the East, Doyle, Orlando City. But they haven't beaten anyone. And I mean anyone. Sorry, Charlotte. It's a peloton of mediocrity below the top three, and we'll dig into that one. And on the bubble, the Union dropped a hammer on New York City to jump the line. Nashville won their second straight and set a point out of the playoffs. That is either, I don't know, good if you're Nashville, or shocking and really sad if you're the rest of us. Montreal spoiled yet another New England home game, and DC watched from afar with an eye towards Saturday. In the West, El Tráfico, that shine wore off for the Galaxy in Portland as Evander outdueled Ricky Puig. Real Salt Lake's bad form, that was one win in their last 6 games, and Chicho's absence for suspension didn't matter, thanks to a hero off the bench. We'll celebrate him in a second. Oh, and FC Dallas are getting a new stadium. Meanwhile, everyone else in the Mad Max battle for seeding out West straight up blew it. LAFC at home against Austin. 3 points, right? Nope. Draw. Colorado at Sporting Kansas City. Surely they would show something. Nope. 4-1 losers. Seattle, you're up 2-1 against San Jose at home. And you drew. And Houston drew at home again to the Caps. Meanwhile, the gap to the playoff line is 4. The Loons are lucky. Everybody below them are basically hapless. What's the best thing you saw, Doyle?
Brian White coming back from his concussion. Thank goodness. We all know how scary those can be. And I'm glad that it seems like they took their time to make sure that he was 100% right. And he came back, came on in the second half, scored Vancouver's equalizer in a huge 1-1 draw for Vancouver. You said everybody in that West dogfight kind of blew it. It's the opposite for the Caps. They went on the road and they got the kind of result that has traditionally been beyond them in these kinds of scenarios. And so the question now, Weeby, is do Vancouver have enough firepower? Because that's what we've been saying all year long. It's like, okay, the Caps are a good team, and they're going to be a good team, and they're going to make the playoffs, and they're going to go out meekly in the first round again. Well, Brian White is one of the best center forwards in this league. Ryan Gold is one of the best playmakers in the league. With the way that Pedro Vite is playing, well, not last night. He wasn't good last night, but with the way Pedro Vite has been playing the past couple months, and the addition of Stuart Armstrong as a DP, Ryan Gold gets to play as a second forward. He doesn't have to be a guy who drops in and orchestrates. And then you have Fafa Picot as well, who's playing the best ball of his career. And so I've said time and time again, they don't have enough quality. You can't beat teams like LAFC or a fully loaded Seattle in the Western Conference playoffs. And now I'm wondering if that's wrong. I'm wondering if they've done enough. I'm wondering if they have enough in this group. And like, okay, last night wasn't a win, but they got a draw at a tough place to play against a team that we both think is really good. That tells me something.
That's the classic Vancouver Whitecaps fallacy you're falling victim to right now, Matt Doyle. Stu Armstrong, by the way, was back in Vancouver for this one. He's still getting up to stuff, but he'll be available at the weekend because Vancouver go to LA on Saturday, 10:30 p.m. Eastern time. A massive game in the Western Conference. Of course, the Galaxy had that El Tráfico victory. They were riding high, and then Evander sort of punctured that balloon. We'll talk Evander and his MVP candidacy in just a second. I was super happy for Brian White. It had been since, I think, Leagues Cup, since we last saw him start in what you call a quote-unquote MLS match. He had played against Pacific in the Canadian Championship and come off after, I want to say, 16th minute. And I think that's where the injury occurred. That was an injury beard, Doyle, was it? Was it not? I don't remember Brian White being fully bearded.
I believe that was an injury beard.
Yeah, it was a nice look for him. It was not a good night for the Houston Dynamo, which we'll talk about in a second. The Dynamo, like the Whitecaps, are actually better in points per game away from home this season than they are at home. And for both Houston and Vancouver, who historically have been home winners, road dogs, it's been a little bit of a weird season. Let's talk about a dog. He's got the dog in him, Anderson Julio, no Chicho for RSL, FC Dallas, coming to Sandy. 1-6 for Pablo Mascherini's boys. All the momentum had seemingly seeped away. Their best player wasn't really scoring goals, wasn't producing. They had sold their second best player and hadn't figured out how to replace him at least immediately. And it was kind of like, okay, RSL, you know, Colorado jumped you at the weekend. Are you going to fall further down the table? But Anderson Julio said, nah, I'm going nuclear, son. He drew a penalty. He scored from midfield, 56 point something yards. And then he scored a tap in at the end. I mean, if you need somebody, put out the back signal. Here comes Anderson Julio to do what he's done for basically 4 years for RSL, which is mostly score off the bench, but be a microwave man when you need him. It was incredible. And it's incredible how many players on RSL figure we can shoot from half field and actually get the job done, though. I remain shocked that this has become a literal trend for this team.
Yeah, it's the second time this year they scored from midfield at home. Did they have another one on the road?
Pablo Ruiz.
But
Pablo
that was
Ruiz last year.
That was last year. That was last
year. Three half field goals in 2 years. Oh, that's not good enough for Doyle.
Fair enough. It was nice to see RSL sort of get back to, I don't know, looking like they're kind of all on the same page again. But
kinda.
At the same time, yeah, it was
it wasn't like a great performance. That's why no. I say it was like a Julio game. You know, you have those matches, every team does.
And that it makes sense. It makes sense against Dallas with the way that they play under Peter Luxon. And to be clear, I'm a fan of the way they play under Peter Luxon, but they have a tendency to open themselves up. They have a tendency to, if they lose a second ball, suddenly there's a lot of space to play into for the opposition. And that's there was a lot of that happening to RSL's benefit in this game. So I think it played into RSL's strengths in a lot of ways. So I don't know, like whether it was ugly or not, whether it was by the book or not, RSL really needed that win. And they got it. And they're right back in the thick of it with the death race and the middle of that Western Conference pack.
I like that. I've been calling it the Mad Max race. I think death race is another good moniker. I guess it's one and the same, but RSL up to 50 points. They're in second. They're only 5 points behind the Galaxy with a game in hand and a pretty easy schedule going forward, which we've talked about repeatedly on this show. So you had the home game against Dallas. Dallas have won one away game all year long. That number stays the same. So you get the dub. It's Portland at home this weekend. That is an absolutely gigantic match with Evander coming to town. Then it's at Austin, Minnesota at home, at San Jose, Vancouver at home. So if you're RSL and you're Pablo Mascherini, yeah, you've got to figure out how to get the chemistry going between Chicho and Luna and Diogo and I guess Anderson Julio or maybe one of those wingers the rest of the way to get yourself back to that flowing, like we win the ball, we go quick game that RSL really killed people with early on. But hey, this was a good result. And Anderson Julio, by the way, let me just give you the stat. Yep. 0.55 goals per 90 over his RSL career.
I mean, that is exactly what you want from a super sub, right? And 100%. most of those have come off the bench. Now there's a lot of data that maybe goal scoring and goal contribution tallies for players who are primarily subs are actually inflated. Because if you think about it, a guy who plays 20 minutes at the end of the game and gets a goal probably actually played 26 minutes. But in the data, it only reflects 20 minutes.
Well, and everybody else had already played 70 minutes before that. So
exactly.
Hey, look, here's
not to take away, but to, I want to.
Would you start him? Would you start him?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Like, as it stands right now, maybe Anderson Julio is the right guy to play on that right wing, given that Lachlan Brook and the Polish fellow whose name I've forgotten and would probably
attempt it.
I will not. I will do no such thing. They're probably going to take some more settling in time. It certainly has looked that way so far. Anderson Julio's not really a natural winger. He's not going to be the playmaker that Andres Gomez was, but he adds attacking width and depth.
Yes.
When you play him out there, and there's a level of chemistry that he has with Chicho and with Diego Luna, and obviously with the rest of the central midfield, save for Diego Gonzalez, I think we might be reaching the point where that is the right answer to RSL's issues.
And look, we'll see a new lineup against the Portland Timbers because, as I said, Chicho was suspended, so was Kotranis. So there will be some changes, and RSL is still trying to figure things out a little bit on the back line. Philip Quinton started it right back in this match for Pablo Mastroeni. Let's just talk Dallas real quick because we're not going to dive into them too much. They are far below the line right now. They're 5 points, 5 games left. They don't win on the road. That's bad news. But they do have a new stadium, Doyle, and it's coming. Toyota Stadium. I don't know if you saw these renderings. It looks absolutely incredible. Every seat is going to be shaded, a bunch of new special spaces throughout the stadium, and increased that more people can get into the stadium. I look at the renderings, and this is classic North American soccer stuff where we're just like, by God, it's a cathedral. Like, but you never know, you know, when those get built and what they look like at the end, but it certainly seems like this will get done. Frisco just has a way of doing sports development. My one point on it, and to just be a little bit of a Debbie Downer. Love the stadium. Love the project. It's absolutely necessary. Toyota Stadium was a great stadium when it was built, when it opened in 2005. But we're 20 years down the line. The upgrades, it's important. The club needed to get that done. And I love that the National Soccer Hall of Fame is there. Dallas, from a soccer perspective, before you open this building, you have to do every single thing in your power to get another trophy in the trophy case, to put on the wall, to paint the wall, to celebrate, to have something for those fans to hang their hat on, because it just still is not good enough from a soccer perspective, and it was supposed to be better this year with Petar Musa coming in, with Velasco, with Ferreira, and due to injuries, due to issues, due to head coaching stuff, we just have not seen it. It was a nice moment that Alan Velasco is back and scored his first goal in 340 minutes.
Days.
Days, those are longer than minutes. But this project still is scuffling from a soccer perspective and from a championship caliber perspective. So, yeah, okay, that's what I got to say. Let's talk Evander. You want to do that?
Yeah, let's talk Evander. Yeah.
Woo! Phil Neville tried to tell us, Doyle. He was saying it since the beginning of the year. He said, I have the best number 10 in the league. And his quote after this match, when Evander got up to 32 goals plus assists, had a couple goals, had an assist in this one, Phil Neville said, I said he was the best number 10 in the league, and people laughed at me. People questioned me. People thought I was joking. To be fair, nobody thought he was joking. Just in a league with Lionel Messi, it seemed absurd. In addition to all the other great number 10s, including the defending MVP, Lucho Costa and others. But Phil Neville might have been onto something. Phil Neville might be right. 14 goals, 18 assists, 32 combined. That ties Diego Valeri's MVP campaign and the Timbers record from 2017. This dude is so special.
Let's give Phil the benefit of the doubt and assume that there was an unsaid except for Messi at the end of his statement about Evander
yes,
being the best number 10 in the league. He's got a real argument. You know, up until the past few weeks, I would have said it's still Lucho by a good distance. But as we've gotten into crunch time in the season, as we've gotten to the stretch run, Evander's gotten better and better. And it's on both sides of the ball. You know, we made this point after the 4-4 against St. Louis that he was setting a tone physically that the rest of the Timbers then followed. And that is kind of rare for a number 10. And he's kept doing that game after game after game. And to your point, 32 total goal contributions. This is MVP territory. I think Hani was 34 2 years ago. Carlos Hill was significantly less than that when he won MVP. You know, the most Landon Donovan ever had was 29. Preki was never over 30. If you want to go back, neither was Marco Echeverri. Neither was Carlos Valderrama. I think Wando was 34. The second highest total all time is Jovinko, 38. Zlatan and Joseph both had seasons with 37. It's heady stuff. And it looks like with the way that Evander's playing and with the way that attack is playing around him, I wouldn't be shocked if he got to 38. I wouldn't be shocked if he equaled Jovinko's tally to be second all time. And if he does that, even if Portland finish in eighth, you have to consider him for MVP.
What's the last MVP that had a team that finished that low? Off the top of my head, I'm trying. Like Di Rosario's MVP season might be.
They didn't even make the playoffs when D-Ro won MVP.
Yeah, like where were the Fire when Mike McGee?
That's another one. I don't think they made MVP or made the playoffs when Mike McGee won MVP. Diego Valeri won in 17, and
yeah.
I don't think Portland were that good that year.
It's difficult here because you look at goals and assists and you just go off the numbers and not to mention the eye test. Then it's Evander on 32, it's Lucho on 29, Lionel Messi on 28, Chicho on 28, and Bawanga on 27. And the thing about Evander is I just don't think the numbers actually do him justice. He is capable, like the way I think about him, and it's been this way all season long, really. It's like he is capable of literally anything he puts his mind to on the pitch. And that's not just a, hey, can you play this really nice in-swinging ball and locate it to the head of your forward? It's, you know, can you start this attack and then run the length of the field and then take the touch in the box being the late arriver and then finish with the same foot as he did in this match against the Galaxy? Is it, you know, can you conjure up this free kick or this moment where there's no possible way you could even put this on frame and yet you make it look simple? Or can you just bully people? Can you be physically and mentally just at a different level? It just seems to me like he does things not in the messy zone, but in the zone of, I can't fathom how someone would imagine doing that, let alone do it and make it look easy. And yet I think it's so difficult when your team is in eighth place for a narrative to form around Evander for MVP, but we had the first sparks of it against the Galaxy. Like, it's been building all year. Phil did a great job kind of putting the tinder around the fire and getting people to think about it, even if they dismissed it. And which, by the way, on our shows, on Countdown, we're like, oh, you know, this is just Phil talking. But in the end, it wasn't. And maybe the best sort of like numerical argument for Evander isn't just his numbers. It's the numbers of the people around him, the Felipe Moras, the Jonathan Rodriguez's, the Santi Morenos, who are all incredible players in their own right. But there's never been a team in MLS history to have three guys score 14 goals in one season for a club. And Evander with 18 assists, Evander with the gravity in the final third, Evander with the instincts and the desire to just grab games in the most critical part of the field is what drives all of it. And so maybe this is an MVP campaign sort of crystallizing in front of our eyes. I don't know. He needs more goals and assists. He needs more momentum. He needs to drive the Timbers up the table probably a little bit. Mm-hmm. But man, the quality is MVP level, unquestionably.
What I'll say is that every time he gets on the ball with a little bit of room to work, I expect it to end up in a high quality chance for Portland. And that's something that you only say, like, it is a shock if it doesn't turn into a high quality chance. And that's something you only say about the very best playmakers in the league, guys who are operating at an MVP level. It's how we felt 2 years ago when Hani was so good. It's how we felt last year and this year about Lucho Acosta. And Evander has that. And on top of it is, as you mentioned, and as I will mention again, the physicality. He's bullying defenders out there every single week now. And the guys around him see that and are very clearly responding to it. It's going to go down as one of the great signings in recent MLS history if they can keep him happy and keep him productive and actually climb that table and start winning things, because all the pieces are there.
Ben hit us up and said, complete hypothetical, which as I read this, you'll see that, yes, I don't think we had to say that, Ben, but I appreciate you, man. If you were to drop Evander into any high seat in the league, what percentage of the MVP vote would he get? Just curious to see what his perception would be on, let's say, a top three seed with 32 goals and assists compared to what he's perceived as on an eighth seed in Portland. So let's just, you know, for funsies here, let's say we're dropping him in on, I guess, LAFC or Columbus. I mean, it's not fair, because if that was the case, things would be completely different. You would be playing in, quote unquote, what would be perceived as more big games. You would have more opportunities in those high leverage games because people see you as one of the best teams in the league in big time situations to go win something, as stepping up in those particular moments. But then I also think about all the moments Evander, in particular in Leagues Cup, has stepped up and been the best player in the field as it is. Like, so it's not a quality question, Doyle. It's really, are we willing to vote for someone for MVP when their team is maybe not playoff borderline, but hovering in the hinterlands around the line? Are you willing? Would you be willing? How would you be willing?
I mean, I don't know. I want your take on it.
I'm just thinking about seeing the ballot and thinking through the names on it right now. And I'm in the camp that Messi hasn't played enough.
Same.
And that I don't think I can, in good conscience, vote for Lionel Messi, which sounds absolutely bat bleep. You know, I'm like, I just couldn't possibly vote for Lionel Messi. That sounds stupid. But the way I think of the award, it wouldn't get me there. Lucho, 29 goals plus assists. From a statistical perspective, he's been better this year than last year. He's had so much less to work with this year than last year, but his momentum has run out a little bit at maybe the wrong time for a MVP campaign. It really is politics.
He needs a strong 5-game push here.
It really is like politics. Suarez, he could do it. He would just have to go nuclear. Benteke has the same problem as Evander, and his numbers aren't quite as mind-blowing. It's not quite as, it's dominant, but it's not, I don't know. It's like he's dominant in this area, and DC are relying on it, whereas I feel Evander is dominant in just a few more attacking areas. There's more variety to his dominance, if that makes sense. No disrespect whatsoever. Cucho's been very good, but you might even argue that, I don't know, his production doesn't match, right? And he has so much, I don't know, it's the production doesn't match. So then it's a spreadsheet game. I could talk myself into it, because Chicho has gone missing too. I think I could talk myself into it. If you see Evander go out there and get around that 40 goals plus assist mark, and the Portland Timbers, who are currently 4 points back of fourth place, jump into a top four seed based on his individual brilliance down the stretch, I think I could talk myself into it, which is not to say I would do it today, but I'm open to it.
It's a conversation for the next month.
That's
right. We're going to be talking about it again. No doubt about it.
Oh, you mentioned his future, and I brought this up on the countdown, and I don't want to be the person that buts Evander's brilliance in Portland, but he was down to go to Brazil in the offseason and spoke very candidly about that on this very show. We checked his salary as compared to the rest of the league. I mean, I think a couple shows ago when there was some discussion about whether or not they should sell him to Qatar. There feels to me like a breaking point coming, and that's not to say that he's leaving Portland, but a breaking point coming where it's like, yo, either you got to sell this guy or he's going to say, pay me my money so I'm happy and I stay. Because I think he's like 2.3 million right now. And if you look at the rest of the league and you look at his talent and his production, he's not a $2.3 million player.
That is correct. And I think that'll be priority number one for the Timbers front office this winter. Whatever happens with the MVP race and wherever the Timbers finish in the standings, that has to be job number one, because he's 26 years old and he's showing that he's potentially an all-time great. And that's a guy that you build around for a half decade at least.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk Galaxy real quick before we roll on out of here. By the way, Portland, as I mentioned, going to RSL on Saturday, 9:30 p.m. Eastern time. That is going to be arguably the game of the weekend. Boy, we had a good time celebrating the Galaxy, and we broke down all the tactics and all these adjustments that they made, and, you know, Mickey Yamane and better positioning, and oh my, they're actually counter-pressing as a group, and ball security is really good. And then some of the old issues that are still present issues popped up against the Timbers. There were a lot of moments in this match where you look around and it's four Timbers attacking against five Galaxy players and nobody's in the midfield. Are the Galaxy a true championship contender?
No.
Like, I know they're the top of the West. I know they have a 5-point gap, but I'm talking MLS Cup. I'm talking championship contender.
I mean, I would be surprised. I would be really, really surprised, because it's exactly what I said on last week's show. Or on Monday's show, rather, where, like, yeah, they had a good game and they made some good adjustments and they were a lot more conscientious of their positioning in terms of rest defense. And I don't trust them to bring it game to game, because I wrote about it in like week two or three, like, look at the new Galaxy. They're, you know, not turning the ball over as cheaply. And when they do, they're structured in a way to win it back. And then I didn't write about that again for 6 months, because we didn't see that again for 6 months. They were winning shootouts. They were winning games by outscoring teams. They weren't winning games by controlling the game. And this was just as good as last week was, or the weekend was, against LAFC. I didn't trust that they would bring it to this Wednesday's game, and they didn't.
No Dejan in the starting lineup. No Edwin Cerillo, who I believe was suspended.
The way I put it, I think, on the pre-show on Monday is the Galaxy have no equity for me in terms of big game performances. Like, okay, it was nice. They won in El Tráfico against LAFC, but we don't see them. Like, this group does not have any history of turning up in big games. They don't have any history of turning up in knockout round games, be it League's Cup or Open Cup or the playoffs. And until I see that, and until they look like the type of team that can strangle the life out of an eighth seed, then it's hard to say this is a championship caliber team. Now, you compare it to LAFC, and LAFC had a stinker over the weekend, and they had another kind of a stinker on Wednesday night, and they're not playing well right now. And I don't blame Galaxy fans for being like, yeah, you're saying this about us, but we're in first place, blah, 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 blah. It'll, yeah, but LAFC make the final in virtually every competition they're in. They can't win a final, and we have thoughts about that, but they have a history of beating good teams in high-stakes games. And that's a difference. And so in assessing the Galaxy versus assessing LAFC, LAFC is going to get the benefit of the doubt, even though I do not like their game model. I actually prefer the Galaxy's game model, but LAFC are going to get the benefit of the doubt from me in a way that the Galaxy will not.
For what it's worth, I think the Galaxy, having talked to folks all season long and recently prior to El Tráfico, would agree with you in the sense that they have not arrived, that they have not yet proven that they are championship caliber, that their big stumbling block is winning the biggest games and beating the best teams and reaching the highest level. Like, Mayo Yoshida has straight up said, like, this was an immature team when he arrived. They're still growing up. They still struggle sometimes with the small details. Greg Vanney told me before El Tráfico, he said, look, are we a good team? Yes. Are we in the driver's seat to win the West? Yes. Is that important? Yes, because it puts us in a position, games at home, where they haven't lost a single game this season, but they still have to prove that they're a championship team, because Greg Vanney knows championship teams are not based on we can score four goals anytime out, which the Galaxy can absolutely do. It's based on the fact that we can shut you out any timeout. We can strangle your opportunities. any timeout. Now, I did mention there was some rotation in this game for Vandy and the Galaxy. We've talked a lot about center backs for LA. I'm not actually sure that's the biggest positional issue that they have. I might argue, Doyle, that it's actually the six. Gaston Brugman is a TAM player. I can't see what Brugman's future is with the Galaxy. Like, they've got to prioritize in the offseason adding someone else in with Edwin Cerrillo to complement that group. Mark Delgado's a great piece, but more of a box-to-box guy in behind Ricky or Marco Royce or whoever. It just feels to me like they need to address that position as well in the offseason. But they got an opportunity against Vancouver this weekend at home to keep things going at Dignity Health. All right, let's talk Inter-Miami, and we'll stick with the Eastern Conference before flipping out west. Inter-Miami went up 1-0 through David Ruiz, who doesn't score in MLS but does for Honduras. He has 3 goals in his last 4 games for the Catrachos. He passes the ball in the back of the net against Atlanta after Tata makes 8 rotations, and I'm thinking this is about to be a blowout. Like, these 55K fans in Atlanta are about to see their team get embarrassed again, but Saba time against Miami is right on time. Saba gets a goal. Drake Callender is going to have some regrets about that one. And then Miami score off a deflection from Campana, who got the start, and Messi comes on right afterwards, and I'm like, this is done, man. Atlanta have no chance. And then Atlanta tightened the screws, and it went to a tactics-free zone, and Alexi Maranchuk had his moment that we've been waiting for, that he's been waiting for, the left foot that is a wand, putting it in a place where Callender could never imagine he could get to, and it ends 2-2. And it probably shouldn't have. So here's the question. Did Miami blow these points, or did Atlanta earn a point? Which one is more correct?
The first one. Miami blew this more than Atlanta earned it, which isn't to say that Atlanta didn't earn it. It's just a matter of degrees. This was, I mean, you remember exactly what happened right before Maranchuk made it 2-2. The was it Messi got saved by Guzan and then falls?
Suarez. Either way, there was like a miracle ball doesn't go in the back of the net sort of moment.
Yeah, and like, as soon as that happened, I was like, oh, Atlanta's going to equalize. This is just the soccer gods playing games with all of us on this one. So that was their 3-1. That was their, okay, we've salted this away. Another 3 points, even though we didn't play particularly well. And they weren't able to do it. They blew it. And to your point, it went to the tactics free zone. And this is why I think there's an argument for Busquets as the team MVP more than Suarez. Busquets, like, it's not like Miami have been immune to going into the tactics free zone this year. There's been a lot of that.
I kind of think they figure if we're there, our pieces are so much more composed in those sort of chaos moments that on the odds we're going to come out on the right side.
I think you're right, but I also think that they would prefer to have pitch control, and that is what Busquets has done better than any defensive midfielder in the history of the game. And when he's not out there, they just are not able to exert that. And that's no slight on Yannick Bright, who I thought was actually really good yesterday, but it's just a soccer IQ drop off from anybody to Sergio Busquets. And this doesn't hurt Miami's shield chances. They're still going to win the shield. Hurts the chances at 74 points, man. And we said it on Monday. That's what they're playing for. They have to make history at this point, given how much they've already accomplished.
I do have some, I don't know, 8 rotations, top 5 center backs for Miami are out. So there are some complicating factors for them. But they've always found a way, and to see them just fall short in that moment, in particular to this Atlanta team, was pretty interesting. You mentioned the points record. 5 games at New York City this week, and New York City just took a hiding at home against Philadelphia. Home against Charlotte, who have won 1-8. At Columbus, okay, that's a very difficult match. At Toronto, okay, that's not a very difficult match, all things considered. New England at home, okay, that's a slam dunk. So let's do our little calculations again. At New York City, how many points?
I'm going to say 3.
3. Charlotte at home.
I'm going to say 3.
6 points. You need 5 more from 3 matches. At Columbus.
0.
6 points, 2 matches to go. At Toronto.
3.
We're up to 9 points. That means you have to win against New England.
Yeah. They have no margin for error.
No.
At this point.
Four wins. It's got to be four wins to get to 11.
Yeah.
Three wins, two draws. I guess, okay, I'm an idiot. Three wins and two draws gets you there.
Oh my God.
The margin's less tight than I originally had portrayed it as, but it's still, they still got to get the job done. 2 p.m. Eastern time Saturday, New York City hosting Miami. It'll be a standalone there. We'll dig into the New York City performance that was. What do you make of Alexei Marinchuk?
Early returns. Yeah, he's a different type of number 10. You could see that he floats more than he orchestrates. He's like a force magnifier in the final third rather than a guy who controls everything. And I, having watched him now for a few hundred minutes in MLS, I kind of wonder if the right move for next year is not to go out and add a winger, which is what we kind of all thought they would do, but to maybe add another number 10.
So you play him on the right wing. He's coming in on the left foot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And then you get a 10, and then you get a number 9 as well. And then what? On the left, it's Saba and Sean De Silva, or I don't know the options right now. It was Christmas Day here recently for us as the new roster profiles came out. I could buy that. I could buy that. That's not what he was billed as necessarily, but I could buy that.
Yeah. The other thing to consider is they still don't have a coach. Now, our good buddy Felipe Cardenas from The Athletic tweeted yesterday he will be surprised if Atlanta's coach is not Patrick Vieira. Patrick Vieira has a sort of modern City Football Group inflected philosophy, which probably means a 4-3-3, but could also mean a 3-4-2-1, kind of like how the Crew play. And that might actually fit best, given that Marinchuk floats and could operate sometimes as a 10, sometimes direct to goal, sometimes drifting out wide. Now, doesn't that sound like Diego Rossi? Doesn't that sound a lot like what we've seen from Kevin De Bruyne at the highest level? So it's there are still so many moving pieces with Atlanta that it's tough to predict what's going to happen. I wish they had their coach already. It would make it a lot easier to talk about what's coming from this team and what this result, like it was a nice result to get in front of their fans, especially with Marinchuk getting a banger to equalize it. But he was pissed in the post game.
Yeah, he was,
and he was right. He was right to be, because his home points dropped in the middle of the playoff race and Atlanta's fading out of this thing.
I believe, and I'm just thinking as you talk coach and DPs, and I've been thinking this for a while, and Garth's history with this guy makes a lot of sense. What was what's Chris Henderson's contract situation? I believe he was out at the end of 2023 and then signed a new one in Miami. Is my memory serving me right? Maybe you can Google that while I talk you through this scenario. Wouldn't Chris Henderson be the no duh obvious Garth Lagerwey brings him back, gives him the CSO position, elevates him from the position he's in Miami, another project to build? Hey, he's the ultimate sort of builder of these sorts of things and salary cap manipulator and scouting mind and fill in the blank. After the time and the success that they had together in Seattle, after everything Chris has accomplished now in Miami, wouldn't that just make a lot of sense from Atlanta's perspective? I don't know about Chris Henderson's perspective, but from Atlanta's perspective, to go hire Chris, to then go hire a head coach, to have two DP spots for him to fill, have expiring contracts and the deck starting to clear a little bit, and you know, and not just top-end talent is Chris known for landing and scouting and identifying, but building out the middle of the roster and bottom of the roster that end up being so important when you have the sort of ambitions and goals that clubs like Seattle and Miami and, of course, Atlanta United have.
I mean, it is absolutely a no-brainer if he's available. I've been furiously Googling to see if I could find any details about his contract. And I haven't been able to find anything concrete as to whether or not he's out of contract at the end of this year. I had thought that he was. I had thought that 2024 was the end of his contract and that he would have had to sign something new to officially be on the books for 2025 for Inter Miami. But I've seen nothing in my Google. We didn't prepare well for this segment, is what I'm saying, Andrew.
It was off the top of my head. I did just find an Athletic story here that's saying, I believe that Henderson is up at the end of 2023. This was written by Jeff Reuter and Tom Boger in October. We'll have to ask Tom to go do some scooping to set us up after we speculated about this potential. Anyway, I'm just going to throw out one last thing on this topic and then we'll move on. You're talking about moving Marancho to the wing, signing a 10, maybe you need a 9. You also probably need a deep lying center midfielder.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of needs. I guess that's the point I'm making. So right now,
They will have two open U22 slots next year because Santiago Sosa and Franco Ibarra are still considered U22 slot occupants for Atlanta United. They haven't cut ties with those guys. They are off the books after this season. So they have some room to work with, but they got to do better with these signings than they have been.
It says here in this Athletic article that Henderson was out of contract winter of 2023. If my memory serves correct, he did get a new deal. We'll defer to Tom Boger on this particular topic. But hey, speculation is fun, no doubt about that. Let's talk about the Eastern Conference. It's the Peloton of mediocrity. It's back for a second straight season. Before we get into the particulars, places 4 through 15, Doyle, just don't seem to be all that good. Maybe Orlando could elevate their way out of that with road games against Columbus and Cincinnati the rest of the way. But Luke Richmond hit us up and said, is this the weakest the entire Eastern Conference has been in half a decade or longer?
It's so top heavy because all three teams at the top are just like super elite teams. And the way the rest of it has played out, like I actually think Philadelphia is much better than their points total. They've just been snake bit for most of the year. And maybe we're starting to see that ship get righted a little bit over the past month and a half. I think that Orlando is much better than their points total. Since they moved Martin Ojeda to the number 10, I think there's something like 8-2-1. And granted, they haven't beaten anybody great, but they've beaten the teams that they've had to, including Charlotte last night in a game that wasn't particularly close. And they also drew Cruz Azul in the League's Cup in a knockout round game, and they eventually lost in penalties. But if you look at what Cruz Azul is doing in the Apertura right now, it's not nothing. So I think it looks worse on paper than I think it is in real life. I think those two teams I mentioned, and I know NYCFC is in a bad place right now. I still like that team's talent. I still think NYCFC is going to figure out how to turn this thing around down the stretch.
Well, they didn't figure it out on Wednesday.
No, they did not.
5-1 losers to the Union. Then they get Miami coming into the building on Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern time. Meanwhile, Philly will play D.C. and Atlanta at home. Philly jumped the playoff line. New England had a 2-0 lead against CF Montreal. They blew that lead. This third straight home game, they've had a lead and blown it and drawn. New England will play Charlotte in Charlotte. Montreal will face Chicago, and it's a game. Nashville won 1-0 against Chicago. They're going to host Cincinnati this weekend, and Orlando, as you said, beat Charlotte 2-0. Meanwhile, Toronto lost at home to Columbus, and Cincinnati went to Minnesota and won. What's your sort of overall feel on this, as I said, peloton of mediocrity around not just the playoff line, but sort of the middle of the table on down? Who proved what? Who had a good result? Who is done and dusted, in your opinion?
Done and dusted going from the bottom. I think the Revs are fully cooked. I think that's that. Chicago, I don't think anybody should be surprised at all at what happened with Chicago coming off a big result and turning it into a kind of a limp performance. Montreal, good point on the road, but I don't, I'm not expecting Montreal to make a push. DC's still in it and kind of out of sight, out of mind, because they didn't play last night, but DC's tied on points with Philly. I gave you my spiel on Philly. Nashville, and I know you're not buying it yet, and I totally get it. They have played better ball under BJ Callahan. They have shown more than just signs of life. They have shown signs of high-level competence with their progression.
Now, hold on. Yeah. Can it be high-level competence when you've lost 8 straight and then beat an Atlanta team that didn't show up with, like, 7 shots the entire game. And I understand there's some really nice possession sequences within there and very good goals, and then beat the Chicago Fire. Can that be a sign of high-level competence?
So if it was just off of Atlanta's mistakes or Chicago's mistakes, if it was just off of set pieces, I would say, no, it's not a sign of high-level competence. But this is actually Nashville controlling the game through midfield and using the ball to create chances. And that was something that we just didn't see anything of for the past year. The last time we saw something like that out of Nashville was in the League's Cup run last season. Hani Mukhtar's got his groove back a little bit. There's a partnership brewing with him and Sam Surridge, and the wingers are getting into dangerous spots. They're progressing the ball through midfield. They're doing stuff that they've always said they wanted to do and only rarely have done. It's still an uphill climb for them to get into the playoffs. I'm not exactly expecting it. But in terms of like, okay, who's playing well? Relative to the rest of this group, Nashville's playing pretty well. And those last couple of losses they had on that 8-game stinker, I don't think those results were emblematic of what this team was doing on the field. And
But I'm looking at it was a 3-0 loss to Orlando at home. They lost 3-0 to Philly. They lost 2-0 to Austin at home, and they lost 3-0 to Orlando. They got beat 10-0 in four games.
The Austin game,
I'm a skeptic.
It's fine. It's totally fine. You're asking me to sell you something, and I'm doing my best. The Austin game in particular was just a couple of self-inflicted mistakes. Right, that first goal, was it Willis who came way out and Bakari got around him? I don't even remember what the second goal was, but they played pretty well through midfield in that game. They were not able to sort themselves out in either box. The last two games, we've seen them sort themselves out in both boxes. Is it going to be enough for them to climb into the playoffs? I don't I wouldn't bet on it, but nobody else is making a super compelling case at this point.
Sell me New York City. You still are holding on to that talent. Belief about their talent. I get it. They haven't won a game in 8, Doyle, and they just, not just got beat, did not show up against Philadelphia and made rudimentary mistakes. Matt Freese, his goalkeeper of the year campaign, he was there for me. I was voting for him. I'm not saying this one game changes things, but this was one of those ones that sticks in your memory as like, ugh.
This is the pattern under Nick Cushing. Remember, I think they had one win in their first 8 to start the season. They started the season with 3 straight shutout losses, I want to say. They were terrible.
He was under a ton of pressure.
Yeah, and then they ended up winning something like 9 of 10. And it was similar last year for big chunks of time where they go down, they go up, they go down, they go up. I feel like they're due for a bit of a come up. Now they didn't play like it last night. If you look at the underlyings, they're, they generated chance and all that, but they didn't start doing anything till they were already down 3-0. It was a terrible performance, and maybe between frustration from that and the pressure of having Messi coming into town on Saturday, I would not be shocked if this team found another gear. And they have talent. They've shown it throughout the year. Guys like Santi Rodriguez and, Afonso Martinez and,
Freese.
Freese, who's been one of the best goalkeepers in the league this year, and Parks and this is a good team. This is a good team. And if they just sort of limp into the playoffs, you have to think that Cushing's seat would start to get pretty warm, because they should be playing better than they are right now.
I would think it's a little bit warm right now. It is 5 draws, 3 losses in the last 8. I went and checked last year, the last 8 games, 1 loss in those 8 games, but just 5 games remaining for New York City. It's Miami at home, very difficult. It's at the Red Bulls, who have significant flaws, but it's a rivalry game. At Red Bull Arena is never easy. That might even be when Emil Forsberg comes back, if Emil Forsberg ever comes back. It's Cincinnati at home. It's Nashville, mighty Nashville, Doyle, at home, and then at Montreal to end the season for New York City. Meanwhile, the Philadelphia Union, they're back to doing Philadelphia Union things. And now that they're above the line, I struggle to see a world where they drop below it, especially because they get to go back home and play DC and Atlanta, direct competitors around that playoff line. And let's be honest, teams that aren't as good. just not on points, not on what they've done so far this season, but just on as you compose a team and look at performances, those two teams are not as good. And that's even with Andre Blake out. I didn't say it in the best thing I saw, but we got to give Andrew Rick some huge props. He was absolutely spectacular against New York City. And that's an 18-year-old homegrown filling in for a freaking legend.
I feel like we've had more 18-year-old goalkeepers over the past 3 years than we had over the first 25 in MLS history. Between Gaga Slonina and Chris Brady and Gavin Beavers and John Polskamp and now this kid who, he was really good. I mean, he made one save last night that was insane.
The one going back behind him where he like paws it out. It's not the Tim Howard save that's always on repeat because that one is just out of this world athleticism. This one is not that spectacular, but nonetheless impressive.
Yeah. Did I mention Gavin Beavers? Gavin Beavers, too.
Yeah, Gavin Beavers. By the way, we didn't mention the Jesus Ferreira goal on Beavers. We got so enamored by the midfield goal from our guy Anderson Julio that nobody talked about Jesus Ferreira being very tuned in to what was happening and firing that free kick off the post while Gavin Beavers was on the post, opposite post, setting up the wall. That was a pretty interesting moment. If you didn't see it, go check out that highlight. Look, no Andre Blake in this one. No Danley Jean-Jacques. Leon Flack was a beast, an absolute beast. He just fits so well with the ethos in Philly. I hope he gets to stick around with that team. I think it would make perfect sense given the transfers that they've had. And then you've got to say, we talked about the Portland trio / quartet and LA Galaxy, obviously, but Kazdag, he just keeps on scoring. Uwa's found something. He's got a little bit of form going. Then Ty Baribo is making Julian Carranza seem like an afterthought, which I never thought would have been possible.
Yeah, he's got, 13 goals in his last 13 games across all competitions. Also got an assist in this one. Fox in the box, you almost forget about him outside of the final third. But then you look and, he actually wins a lot of second balls. He contests. He doesn't win a lot of first balls. But that's all right. In the Union's game model, you have to just make them feel you physically on that first ball so that they can't direct it into a place where you don't have numbers. And so he does a lot of work. And when it's Ura contesting the first ball, Baribo's been really smart about winning that second ball and helping Gazdag or Jack McGlynn or sometimes even Flock get on the ball and the Union start their very direct, very rapid sequences. And once that starts, he's almost Wando-esque about finding spots. Or actually, it's more like Brad. It's like our good friend Bradley Wright Phillips in terms of his box movement, the way he's able to create that 2 yards of space and find those one-touch finishes. And that's what golden boots are built on, man. Like, you can score bangers. You're only getting 4 or 5 of those a year. One-touch finishes in the box, that's what wins you golden boots. That's what generates consistent goals. That's what Ty Baribo has been doing, and that's why the Philadelphia Union have been winning.
We've been bagging on a lot of teams in this Eastern Conference mess that is basically 4 through 15. Let's try to give Orlando some credit here. I think it's now, 7 wins in their last 9 games? They beat Charlotte 2-0. Facu Torres gets a goal in this one. Martino Ojeda continues to look very, very good. Duncan McGuire had a beautiful little chip there at the end. And yet, I just can't quite buy in, despite the talent, despite the track record from last year, Doyle. And the reason is this. I'm just going to read off the list of wins for Orlando this season. Austin, Philly, when they were just snake bit 100%. San Jose, Chicago, Toronto, DC twice, Nashville twice, New England twice. That's like the opposite of Murderer's Row.
For sure. You can only play the teams in front of you. The teams in front of them this weekend happens to be the Columbus Crew. So that'll be a good litmus test. I'm not expecting Orlando to take points out of this game. I think you're downplaying it too much. This team was on 63 points last year. This team this year struggled the first half of the season until Martin Ojeda was made the number 10. Since then, they have been one of the best teams in the league. As I said before, mixed into that, here's who they beat. They also drew Cruz Azul in the round of 32 in the League's Cup. And I know League's Cup is different from MLS regular season play, and Cruz Azul was near the start of their season. Cruz Azul is running away with the Apertura. They are a juggernaut right now in Mexico, and that was a really good performance from Orlando City in that game. I look at the talent they have. I look at the way they are putting away teams that they should be putting away. And it's hard for, like, I see no reason not to be bullish on this team. At Columbus, at Dallas, home to Philly, at Cincy, home to Atlanta. I'm not expecting them to take four wins out of that, but I think they'll get a couple. And I think that they'll go into the playoffs as the number four seed in the Eastern Conference.
Hey, Man City didn't beat the big teams in the EPL last year. Just saying. Just throwing that out there. Meanwhile, for Charlotte, that's one win in eight so far. That might have been a nonsensical addition to that conversation. Okay. Let's transition to the Queen City, though. Brent Bronico had this to say after that 2-0 loss on the road. And again, one win in eight for Charlotte. Quote, "We're in crunch time and we need to figure out who we are as a team again very quickly. That's not what you want to be hearing this time of year. Certainly Dean Smith is not happy with the performances. He said afterwards, we've got a lot of guys who want to come back to the ball and not enough guys who want to create space and run in behind." Look, Pat Ajimon was back. Feels to me like the Karol Swiderski experiment retry here is got to be over. Toklamadi, they've elevated to the first team. The Israeli striker they signed in the transfer window sort of quietly. Liel Abada's not really playing well or producing. Kerwin Vargas has gone pretty quiet. Just overall, Charlotte is looking for something here. They are safely-ish a playoff team right now in seventh on 38 points. But there is a chance, given their form, they could fall down to that wild card and perhaps even further if the wins keep eluding them. But they've got a big game coming up this weekend, so we'll see what they can do with that. Charlotte going to host New England at 4 p.m. on Saturday. That is, in every way, shape, and form, a must-win game for Charlotte. All right, let's just quickly hit these Ohio teams. Columbus and Cucho rotated. They go to Toronto. Toronto had a bunch of injury issues, especially on the back line. Osorio left at halftime. Cucho came on in the 50-something minute, and then scored in the 50-something minute and set up a goal. And yeah, he's Cucho. He's one of the top five players in the league, and he's going to win you points. Meanwhile, Yuya Kubo is a match winner for FC Cincinnati in Minnesota. Doyle, these goals were sick. The first one, you were calling out the entry pass from minute one, and the second, the flick from Kubo to Luca Orsano is pure magic.
The extra touch from Orsano to freeze the defense in the box. Just two absolutely beautiful goals from Cincinnati, and another really good result. Because I don't think Minnesota were bad in this game.
No, Pat Noonan said it. We were under pressure and we defended well in our area, which was a hallmark of the Shield winning team, and has been less so a hallmark of this team since Miazga went down.
Yeah, I would like to see them exert a little more control through central midfield. I think they were able to do that at a higher level at times last year than we've seen from them, but like, it's understandable given all the changes that they've had to endure. But this was a really good win from Cincinnati. It's a matter down the stretch here of figuring out the best 11. Like, you're a believer that Yuya Kubo has to start up top.
He has to.
I think you're right.
On this team stretches the field in behind at all or has the instincts to do it. Nobody else seems to have the instincts to set up their teammates among that forward group that they have. I just think 10 goals so far this season, when Cincinnati have looked at their best, their most dangerous, it had been with Kubo in that front three somewhere.
And then the question is, all right, is it a 1-2 or is it a 2-1 where it's like, Jamil Assad is the left wing back and then Lucho and Orsano is sort of like dual tens and then Kubo up top, or is it Orsano is the left wing back, or maybe even Orsano is the right wing back?
I think it's Orsano is the right wing back. I think, having talked to Pat Noonan, I think that's where he sees Orsano
and then you play Joachini up top, yeah, with Kubo, and then where does DeAndre Eden play?
Yeah, that's an open question. Yeah, it's probably more likely, just based on getting your best players on the field, that Orsano would be your left wing back as they started the season, and Yedlin would be on the right. Like, if you're if you're Pat and you're just saying, I just got to get my best guys out there, I know that they can adapt. They've done it all season long.
Yamil Assad has been better than DeAndre Yedlin this year.
Well, then you have a question mark there, right?
Yeah, and this is what, like, I still think Cincinnati are a top three team very clearly in the Eastern Conference, top four team in the entire league. I think they are a tier threat to win MLS Cup. It is a little odd that we don't know their formation or their best 11 at this point in the season. You know, figuring that out down the stretch, almost more important than winning games. That said, winning games is really important because they need home field in that second round against the Crew.
Do they?
I think so.
1.6 points per game at home this year, Cincinnati, 2.21 points per game away. They're the fourth team all time to win 10 away games.
Really good for them. You want to go try to win at lower.com field in the playoffs against this Crew team? No, thank you.
They won 2-1 there earlier this year. I'm just playing devil's advocate. Yeah. I'm just messing with you. Anything else to add? Any final thoughts?
No,
on the
just
East?
Like I'm glad that Wilfred Nancy is very clearly a listener to the show because he rotated his squad
Damn
in a big
right.
way. Our guy Derek Jones got 90 minutes. You know, changed the wing backs up, changed some of the center backs up. Got Darlington Nagbe some rest, which I was happy to see because remember, by this time next week on this show next week, we'll be talking about Campeones Cup. They have to beat Club America in that one. Another trophy on the line for Columbus.
Yeah, they got a pretty packed schedule down the stretch. And Wilfred said before the match and the lead up, basically, we really got to focus on our health. And that makes sense. They're not going to win the Shield. So make sure that you are in prime condition to win a couple trophies. Campeones Cup, but of course, defending MLS Cup as well. Okay, Western Conference, the Mad Max race. The teams are better than the East, but the results didn't really reflect that up and down. So I ask you this question. After a midweek match day in which LAFC drew at home to Austin, Seattle drew at home to San Jose, Houston drew at home to Vancouver, not that bad, and Colorado got smoked on the road in Kansas City, who biffed it the hardest?
That's a really good question.
Choose your failure.
There's a lot of competitors. It's probably Seattle because they gave up home points against San Jose with a late sort of dead legged defensive performance where San Jose's subs were able to just sort of run past them and score the game or score the equalizer. And that should have been 2 points. And if they had taken 2 points from that game, I think they would have been in fourth place. And that's where they want to be. They want to have home field in that first round of the playoffs. It's not devastating, but that was a tough one for the Sounders. A very tough one.
As it stands right now in the West, in case you're not constantly looking at the standings like I tend to be, Galaxy still in first, 5-point gap. RSL, LAFC, Colorado round out those top four spots. Seattle, Vancouver, and Houston in the 5-6-7 zones, aka they won't have to play in the wild card game, so they're real playoff teams, but they won't have home field advantage in the first round. And Portland and Minnesota are in the 8th and 9th spot with Austin and Dallas chasing, but 4 and 5 points back respectively. It kind of feels like the distance is going to be a little bit too far for them. What was the issue for LAFC? Where was the failure for them?
I think it's dead legs. They just look like a very tired team right now, which is understandable. In part because they went on a long Leagues Cup run and in part because they haven't done a great job of rotating the squad throughout the year. They're also playing on the break more than they maybe should be. They should be using the ball more, especially now that they have Giroud and he's so good in possession.
Their one goal, they did. Like when you watch that one goal, it is a possession sequence. It's sort of the mind's eye that we had this year when they were playing more with the ball and they brought Giroud in, and you're like, okay, well, this is how it could work, where you have Giroud dropping in and runners advancing off of him and he can hold it up and kind of, you know, find those little gaps that provide space. And now all of a sudden the center backs are pulled out because they follow Giroud, and then bing, bang, boom, you have good movement, good passing, precision in the final third. And David Martinez was the beneficiary, but it just wasn't enough. And then a very uncharacteristic moment for Aaron Long, I would say, also on the goal for Javier Obrion.
Yeah, he got buried. Is there anything you're seeing that makes you feel like LAFC aren't going to be the Western Conference favorites heading into the playoffs?
The only thing that I would point to right now is that when they were at their most dominant, when they were just, I mean, rolling everyone outside of Columbus and Houston, it was when they had gone more towards that very direct 3-4-3 formation. We're going to be extremely comfortable in terms of how we defend. We can defend deep, no problem. And then we're in positions to really break quickly, and we have players that are just better at that than you. And then they went out and got midfield depth, which is what I thought they needed. Now, Murillo's injured, and they don't know when he's coming back. And I think that's an underrated injury that we haven't talked about enough, because it doesn't take away the 3-4-3, but it requires either that Eddie Segura plays in that, or that Marlon Santos, who just arrived, plays in that. And chemistry and those relationships on the back three with Chenault and Long and Murillo had seemed to be so strong. That's the one thing that I would say, but they have time to figure that out. What they don't have is time to recuperate. So, like, I actually think their biggest issue might just be that freshness, that they've been so uber reliant on the same players all year long, that there might just be a fuse that's coming up for this team, and they don't really have a break because they play midweek for Open Cup. They play on the international break date. On the international break date, Denny Bwanga is going to go 50 hours to Africa and 50 hours back, and then have to play decision day, and then have to flip into the first round. It just feels like a lot of things are mounting on them in terms of fatigue and in terms on options in critical parts of the field for Steve Cherundolo.
Let me give you a stat. From 3.5 months, from mid-May until early September, LAFC played 24 games across three separate competitions. Over those 24 games, the only team they lost against was the Columbus Crew. They lost
that tracks.
Two games to the Crew, minus six goal differential against all other comers, which again includes teams in three different leagues. They were 19 wins, no losses, three draws, plus 45 goal differential. I think that's the real version of LAFC.
Oh my God. Plus, I heard that and then it had to settle for a second. Plus 45?
They were smoking teams, and it looks bad right now. And I think they've lost a little bit of who they are, maybe because they've just been emphasizing the main thing they are too much to the exclusion of the other things. I think that's the real version of LAFC. And I think if they find that version of themselves down the stretch, they will be prohibitive favorites to come out of the West.
Would we be talking this way about, fatigue, bad, all this stuff, had they, after scoring the two goals against the Galaxy and then giving up one, had they switched back to that 3-4-3 and just shut it down? Because they still kept it in the four-man back line. If they had just shut it down against the Galaxy, would we be expressing sort of this, maybe fatigue, what's wrong? Or would it be like, no, this team is fine. Like, yeah, this draw against Austin is more out of character than anything else.
I think we would still be talking about fatigue. I think it's very obvious in the way that a few of these teams are playing. And it's one of the things that we were just praising Wilfried Nancy for, was for his ability to rotate and get his guys. Like, Diego Rossi only played 45 minutes. Cucho only played 45 minutes. Max Arston came in late, and Mo Farsi came in late. So it's like, it's the same thing for all of these teams that made big runs. I don't see why it would be different just if one result had gone differently for LAFC.
I'm a little bit perplexed by Houston at home this year, Doyle.
I'm a lot perplexed by Houston
at home. They were so good last year, and they used that advantage and the heat and everything else. And, I've talked to some people around the club, and one of the things they've said, which sounds silly and like an excuse sometimes, but I don't think is, because it's historically been very indicative. It just hasn't been as hot in Houston around game days, but it was actually a heat advisory last night against the Vancouver Whitecaps. And it was one of those Dynamo games where they have 65% of the ball. And even Vanni Sartini said, hey, they were very clearly the best team in the first half, but Ibrahim Aliu is just a step offside on a goal that gets taken off. Aliu doesn't get the penalty call when Pedro Vite steps across him. We'll hit it on IR. I'm not sure it's a penalty, but it kind of looks like a penalty. And then they just don't have the firepower and they don't get it done. And they give up a bad goal, and it's 1-1, and you're like, why is this team with historically an incredible home field advantage, who built their success on that home field advantage last year, better on the road in 2024? You have a theory?
I don't.
My theory is my only theory is this, and it goes back to the attacking personnel they have. Other teams, when they go to Houston, know they can't match up with Houston in terms of possession and controlling the field. So why try? It's better to take away the space in and around the 18, to take away the space that Houston want to combine and just say, beat us. I don't know that you have the guys in those areas to do it. And more often than not, that's worked out. And Ponce has been a fine player. Maybe he needs to be a little bit more efficient for them to reach a different level.
Bossy. Bossy is one of the...
It's a dare still.
Yeah, Bossy is one of the biggest underperformers this year in terms of goals under expected.
All you is extremely variable, let's just say.
He's not a guy who turns possession moments into goals. Aliu is really dynamic in the open field.
Yes, he needs space.
Yeah.
And Vancouver didn't give it to him last night. And that works. That's why Vancouver are good on the road. If you ask Vancouver to dictate games at home, they're like, well, we're not as good at that. But if you give us space and Ryan Gauld can go running with options in front of him, yeah, we're pretty darn good at that. Anyway, how about the Rapids? They've laid some eggs this year, but they've always recovered. Will they recover at home against Toronto this weekend after that shellacking against Kansas City?
I think they will. They've been very resilient. My one worry is like LAFC and Columbus, they had a long Leagues Cup journey and they don't have a ton of depth.
Yeah.
I don't think the Sporting Kansas City game was them sort of running out of steam. I think it was them maybe struggling in the middle of that back line a little bit and just kind of coming out flat. And by the way, Sporting are playing pretty good ball right now, so that's part of it as well. But I'm not as worried about Colorado as I guess maybe I should be. But we'll see. If they don't get 3 points at home against Toronto, a Toronto team that is not playing good ball at the moment, then maybe some alarm bells sound.
Weird one for the Rapids in the sense that Lalas Abubakar was out on concussion protocol. So Michael Edwards, 23-year-old up from the two team, started his second ever game in MLS. And he had a goal, a back heel, and then he had some moments defensively where Pulido made some plays in this game where you're like, somebody tackle him. Somebody, yeah. Anybody, tackle this guy. But Sporting Kansas City looking at least like a good bet to challenge LAFC in downtown LA in the U.S. Open Cup final, which goes down next Wednesday, I believe, right after Campeones Cup. So a night of championships around Major League Soccer next week. All right, I think that's all we... Oh, nope, no. Oh, no. No, we had one more thing. Sebastian Driussi got on Twitter last night, Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
And the retweets are no longer around, but screen grabs always exist. He was retweeting, let's just say, some constructive criticism about his role and about the future of Austin from the fans. What do you think here? Trade Seba was one retweet. I think it's time to move on from Driussi was one retweet. He's feeling it a little bit, huh?
He is, and I don't blame him for feeling frustrated after the season, the past two seasons, really. But if you look at his performance and his body language this year, I don't blame the fans for maybe being a little frustrated as well, especially when you consider, you know, he's on the type of money that we were talking about Evander needing to get. And that's going to make it very difficult to move on from Sebastian Driussi. He's over $6 million, man. He's one of the highest paid players in the league. Nobody in MLS is trading for that. Okay, well then can Flamengo?
That's a Brazil. That's a Brazil.
Yeah, and like deal. You look at the standings and Flamengo are shocking this year. And like, is there a panic buy coming? Can they maybe throw you a lifeline or, you know, Corinthians, something like that? Gremio are, I think, pretty low in the standings. So like you just hope that something like that, if he really wants to be out of there, that's where the lifeline is going to come from. Maybe River Plate. Maybe
feels like if it's River Plate, it's probably a loan situation where Austin is still picking up a bunch of that money. I mean, because he's guaranteed through 25 with an option for 26. It's a very big deal. You could, I guess, come in and buy him out if you're Austin, if that's really what you want to do. But then you're buying him out at, like, I think his number is above $5 million, I want to say. So, like, you're buying him out at a number that is essentially a transfer fee for a huge amount of money to spend just to get rid of a guy who you'll then have to go replace with another big old bundle of cash. So they got
$5 million is what Hani Mukhtar cost. It's what Denny Bawanga cost. $5 million goes a long way.
And then you have to pay that guy. Yeah. So it's a lot of money. We'll see what happens in Austin. There's a lot of question marks around the league, especially below the playoff line. One of those question marks is in Chicago. There are some rumblings about Greg Berhalter. Perhaps those discussions heating up. We'll let you know if there's ever any fire on that one. Still just smoke for the time being. But hey, that's it for us. Anything to add?
Pun intended there?
No, not intended. I'm barely functioning, Doyle. I woke up at 11:45 on a Thursday. So
don't forget to pick up your mom.
I will not. Nana's coming. The boys are excited. And we got more soccer coming on Saturday. All the coverage, MLSsoccer.com. 2 p.m. Eastern time on Saturdays when things get started. New York City hosting Inter Miami. We got a game at 4 p.m., then 6:30 p.m. Eastern time. MLS Countdown on MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. We'll have the highlights from those first two games, break them all down, get you ready for the night that will come later. And then on Sunday, a big game around the playoff line in the East, D.C. and Philadelphia at 6:15 p.m. Eastern time. As always, thank you so much for listening. We're out of here. Adios. We'll be right back.